RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 139 with guest Bhargav Shukla, recorded Wednesday, December 2nd, 2009. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio. Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. With me, as always, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
Hey, everybody. Richard?
Sir?
What's happening?
Not too much. You up for a run-as?
Oh, yeah. Always up for run-as radio. It's a good thing. More exchange topics to dive into.
You bet. I brought back our favorite exchange person, Bhargav Shukla. He's a premier field engineer at Microsoft, always fascinated by computers. He is, by education, a civil engineer, which explains a lot, really. In his 14 years of IT experience, he's had the opportunity to work on a multitude of technologies, including messaging, directory services, information security, virtualization, and more. He holds industry certifications from Microsoft, VMware, RSA, and Citrix. And when he's not working with enterprise clients, Bhargav contributes to the TechNet forums and blogs about Exchange at www.bhargavs.com. Welcome back, Bhargav.
Thank you very much, guys.
The premier field engineering, you have an interesting background, a lot of different things, but the different areas that you've worked in sound like they would give you some really broad and deep experience having to deal with a lot of different types of enterprise systems.
Yeah, and being a premier field engineer now, I focus only on Exchange. That's my area of focus. But as you see, before starting as premier field engineer, I did work on a lot of other technologies. And even being a PFE, working only on Exchange, I still, when I work with clients, do see and get exposed to different technologies, including, you know, working with the Active Directory team. I work with customers, Active Directory gurus, and talk to them when we have to discuss the Exchange updates, schema updates, and what's involved in that. So, yes, relatively less now, but working on different technologies did give me a good benefit when I work with customers. I see where they're coming from, what their thought process could be when they ask a certain question. It definitely helps.
Well, certainly dealing with Exchange, you have to touch so many different other things, you know, the big stuff like Active Directory, you know, different types of storage, you know, do you have virtualized environments here or there, maybe not for an Exchange server per se, although I think we've all seen crazy stuff being done with Exchange.
Correct.
But what a great background to bring to the table.
Yeah, it like I said, it definitely helps because when you're working with different technologies, Exchange touches Active Directory, touches communications platform. If you're using Microsoft, you know, the OCS, BlackBerry is a favorite one for the enterprises. So it does help.
So where are we going to go in Exchange today, guys?
Well, I guess we can definitely talk about building upon the last podcast. We can definitely talk about high availability. That's one of the very important features where
sure.
Exchange 2010 brings a lot of advances, a lot of new features there.
I've been reading on the Exchange site this concept called mailbox resiliency. Maybe we should.
Right.
That's a great phrase, but what does it really mean?
Does it bring a lot of questions in your mind as well? What does that mean?
Yeah.
Why is it mailbox resiliency
now?
What
is that? Yeah,
sounds
exactly.
Really cool.
It sounds good. I like it.
So, if you start from 2003 and 2007, you know, 2003 had this mailbox clustering, as we like to call it, the single copy clusters. It used Windows clustering and had two servers, one active, one passive, had the Exchange CMS running on top of it, which had the mailboxes on top of it, databases, mailboxes, everything. And in 2007, that was improved with using the CCR, where now you're not using the shared copy, which is SAN. You're not going to the same copy of your database. Now you have two separate copies, whether it's on SAN or whether it's on a direct attached storage. Basically, you have two separate copies. So now we have a cluster which provides you the service resiliency or fault tolerance. When service goes down on one server, your service keeps running on the other one. And then with CCR, you had the ability to keep it running with a separate copy of database. So if your SAN had an issue on one set of disks, and if you're still using the SAN with CCR, you would have the second set of disks working.
Right.
And again, that's an assumption. And if it was DES, well, obviously you have two separate DES subsystems. So that just added a layer of resiliency. Now, in 2010, what we have done is we have take it a step further. Now, you don't have that concept of CMS or CCR. You don't have the CCR. CCR is gone.
Really?
Yes. So that shouldn't come to you as a surprise if you're an exchange person and have been catching up on 2010. But if not, hey, CCR is no more, and so is SCR, the secondary site copy, right? That's gone too. And what it is replaced by is the database availability groups.
Okay.
So the DAG, what it does is it works as the CCR and SCR if you want to compare the features. So the DAG basically breaks the components down to the database level. So what you can do is you can implement a database availability group across a bunch of mailbox servers and then take a database. So you can have five databases on a server, but you can decide to have only a database copied to other servers. So you will have a copy of that given database that you selected over multiple servers. Now, what that gives you is flexibility of deciding which database will be copied over to which servers. You could have 10 servers, and you could have one database copied only to three servers. And that gives you the ability to have second database replicated to the other three servers and so on.
Okay.
It's one of the options. It doesn't have to be that way. There are many different ways you can cut it out.
Now, when you create this kind of redundancy, are you able to use those machines to improve performance as well? Because it seems like a lot of gear just for redundancy.
Well, and when you think about it, in CCR, you had a server A and server B. Server A was active, primary, then the server B was sitting there.
Right. Active, passive.
Right. With the database availability groups, you have multiple databases. You don't have to have all your databases active on one server, and then the other server is just sitting there doing nothing. What the database availability group now allows you to do is you could have database 1 active on server 1. You could have database 2 active on server 3. You could distribute your load across the servers. And that's the beauty of it.
And in each of those servers is then the redundancy server for one of the other ones.
Correct.
So this is similar to the way we do this in SQL Server as well, where
right.
server 1 has database A and server 2 has database B, and they are the failover for each other.
Right. Now, I'm not sure how it works in SQL Server, but in Exchange, so what you have is, it is similar, like you said, but you could still have one database availability group. So you have these multiple mailbox
right.
servers in the same group. However, you could still have your databases spread across different servers as an active one.
I could spread database A across and have copies of that on multiple other servers, not just on one.
Right. So your database 1 could be active on server 1, but it could have a copy of it in server 3, server 5, and server 10. So you have a total of 4 now.
And gotcha. And those are complete copies?
They are complete copies.
And what's in those databases? Is that just mailboxes that are in that database?
Yes.
Okay, which is the main thing, is people want their mailboxes preserved.
Right, and you have to remember, you know, that these are the copies just like it used to be in CCR. So you have a database, it's seeded for the first time, and then you have the transaction logs
right.
Replayed as they fill. So you will always have one or two or a couple databases, depending on your infrastructure. You would be lagging a little bit behind.
And how much is a little bit, roughly?
If it is up to current, and if it is given, let's assume that it's in the same data center and you're on the high-speed links and you don't have any latency on the network side, then usually you would be 1 to 2 databases behind, 1 to 2 logs behind.
Okay, and how often are the logs shipped?
as soon as the log is written. So you have one log that is always current.
Right.
And when that log is filled, it's written on the disk. It's shipped as soon as it's closed. So the service waits for the log to close. And once the log is closed, your current log stays locked. It cannot be shipped.
Right.
But the one that just got closed would be shipped over to the other server.
And in exchange, we have the ability to define how often those logs are rolled over?
Yes. So in, if you're talking about the logs itself, when the logs, as the transactions roll in, the log size now in Exchange 2010 and in 2007 is 1 meg. So every 1 megabyte, it will create a new log.
Okay.
Right.
And,
right.
And so now it totally depends on how busy your Exchange server is,
how busy your Exchange servers are. Right.
Right. Okay.
Right.
That makes sense. And I think for me, the distinction here is that adding more servers as part of that cluster doesn't slow down the site because you're not waiting to do synchronization across them before you complete transactions. It's all asynchronous.
Right. So if you think about it, this is not synchronous. This is not mirror.
Right. It's
not. It doesn't have to wait for the transaction to go. The primary server that has active database, it continues to write its logs. It continues to function as it does.
Right.
And when the log is closed, that log gets shipped over to the other server.
Yeah, so this is just like SQL Server log shipping, effectively.
Yes, it is log shipping. So the functions are asynchronous.
In Exchange 2010, how does a failover work? What is it? What's going on behind the scenes, and what does it look like?
So now here, the improvements help a lot. Let's take the failure at different levels. You have a failure on the server, right? The server entirely failed, and you had 2 active databases on it. The database availability group looks at it and says, okay, the server has failed. Where are the copies? And the copies are given the preference number. So whichever is the next preferred number, it would activate that database. So your mailbox database 1 has a copy on server 2, server 3, and server 4, but server 2 is given preference because it has number 2, then that will activate. And the activation is usually pretty quick.
What does pretty quick look like?
30 seconds.
So from the Outlook, from the customer's point of view in Outlook, he's going to see lost connection to Exchange, and then maybe 30 seconds later, regained connection to Exchange. And that's
it. Is where, from the last time we had discussed the changes in the client access server, where now the clients connect to the client access server, not directly to the mailbox server. So what will happen is your connection to the client access server will still stay alive. And the client access server has a component that basically will check the availability of your mailbox database. And it says now that the server 1 is not available. Where is the copy activated? Server 2. Okay, so I will now talk to server 2. So for the user, it would become pretty transparent.
Yeah, they're not even going to see the lost connection, reestablished connection, because their connection is maintained the whole time.
Right. Now, you have to remember, if you're using the Outlook web app, you would see an error if you were actively trying to send an email at that particular time.
Right.
All you have to do is retry the operation.
Yeah.
Refresh your browser or hit resend, you know, hit the send button again.
Well, that's that classic, you know, less than a minute threshold where people will be willing to hit refresh and it'll just keep going. They'll ignore the error.
Right. Right. So you would not lose your written email in the Outlook web app that you have to draft again or, you know, like I said, just refresh the browser or hit the send again and it would send your mail away.
So, Bhargav, I'm trying to think through the sort of progression of scaling the system for redundancy or reliability like this. So if I'm starting with a single server running Exchange, do I just duplicate that to start on redundancy, or do I move the other roles off first?
So this is interesting. Now, you brought 2 questions. Let's address each one separately. So the first one is, you know, how do I build my cluster?
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember previously, you had to have all your servers in place. You had to have your Windows clustering configured before you can install your Exchange.
Right.
2010 departs from that mentality. So what you can do now is you could have 1 server installed as your regular server running mailbox role and you could have a database on it. Now, tomorrow, if you have more ability, you know, you have finance and you have ability to buy more servers, you bring in another server and say, hey, you know what? I have two servers. Why don't I just make it clustered?
Right.
Well, what you can do is you can just create a database availability group now and then take your existing database and say, I want to make it part of this DAG and I want to replicate it to so-and-so server. And so it allows you to do that later on. You don't have to have it up from day one.
Right, because in 2007, I actually had to set up clustering first and then install Exchange, and it did a special install of Exchange.
Right. And that's what you don't have to do in 2010.
So are we saying that in 2010, clustering is sort of the default? It's just enabled, and you can either just have a single node cluster, or then you can just add more as you go. It sounds like what you're saying.
Well, so what happens is when you install the mailbox role on Exchange 2010, it doesn't have clustering enabled. It still relies on the operating system and the clustering offered by Windows Server 2008. But what it does is when you enable the when you establish a DAG, it will go ahead and create the cluster resources for you. And if you don't have the clustering role installed, as in 2008, you have to install different roles. It will install it for you if you are on that mailbox server where you're trying to create the DAG.
Gotcha. So what's happening is Exchange 2010 is making it easier for me and doing some of the work for me in the background.
Correct. It's doing a lot of that work for you in the background. Now, what you have to remember here is since you are still reliant on that clustering technology, you have to make sure that when you install your operating system, it is the correct one, which is Enterprise and Data Center Edition of Windows Server 2008. If you are on 2008 Standard Edition and then you later on decide to establish Database Availability Group, you won't be able to because it doesn't have the clustering feature set.
So at that point, I'd probably... Let me see if I can figure this out. So I'm on Standard with Exchange. I decide I want to use a DAG. I have to stand up a new server with Enterprise on it and then set Exchange up on that and migrate to that so that I can take down the Standard one, rebuild it as an Enterprise machine?
Right, because since it is Standard, we do not have the upgrade supportability. So we do not support that... you just take your Windows 2008 Enterprise CD, stick it in, and say, upgrade my existing server. That's already running Exchange Server. You cannot do that.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
So like you said, you will have to go to the other server, stand it up as an Enterprise, and then create a database, move your users off, because it's the same Exchange org, you will be able to do that.
Right.
Now, since you brought up that point, it's a very good point we can discuss about, and that is in 2010, when you move the mailboxes, it's live migration. So users don't have to disconnect.
And this comes back to your original point that the users aren't connected to the mailboxes anymore. They're connected to client access servers, so you can move mailbox servers around, and the client access server will deal with it.
Right. And the way the mailboxes are moved is different as well. So if you're running a 2007 SP2 and then moving the mailboxes off to 2010, that experience is a live one also for the user. Whereas in previous versions, if you remember, user would get a message that they're not connected to their mailbox or administrator is making the changes and they will have to log off and log back on.
Well, and we talked about this a little bit in the previous show where migration from 2003 to 2010 is just fine. It's not a big deal, but it is an offline migration. And in 2007 SP2, you can do an online migration.
Right.
Okay.
And when you say offline, you know, relatively, usually it is scheduled. So you schedule the users, you know, when they're not working and non-working hours. So it's still non-impactful to users if it's planned properly, but it is offline.
And it does need planning, and it does mean there's a bunch of IT guys working at late hours of the night to make it happen.
Yep. with this, if you had 2007 SP2 and you were going to 2010, it actually gives the IT guys a relief that, hey, they don't have to work long hours and in the night. Well, that does not mean one of the managers won't say, I'm not comfortable with this and you'll still have to work offline. But that's a non-technology issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, I meet IT guys who actually love the fact that they work at night. They don't have to deal with all the staff all the time. And then I also find folks, anytime I can actually do something during the day, I'm happier. So
exactly. If it wasn't for the people, this job would be, and the technology and the software companies, if it wasn't for all that, this job would be great. So I'm kind of curious. I'm going to go way back here, and I know this has probably changed over time, but I'm just curious what it looks like today, or if it's even a factor anymore. But thinking way back to the Exchange 5.5, before we started putting 2000 and something on Exchange, and before 5.5, about a fragmentation of the mailbox stores and data stores, is that still an issue today, or is that something that we need to think about in terms of maintenance, and does it impact our availability or performance?
Yeah, you did have that until 2007, and what that means is in 2010, it's not. One of the biggest problems, if you remember, was that your backups were running and your fragmentation and online maintenance were running at the same time. Well, and that conflicted, you know, the window conflicted. You had the resource issues, whatnot. Not anymore. With 2010, your online defragmentation is running 24/7.
So the databases are constantly defragging themselves.
Right. And you have to remember why. That's because it is enabled a lot because of the storage changes. The way the data is written, we talked about briefly last time, is, you know, the coalesced I/O, larger page sizes, a different way of writing the database. It's sequential instead of random. And it gives an opportunity to do that. So what Exchange 2010 does is it runs the online defragmentation in background 24/7. And what it also does is it runs in the background as a lower priority process. So it does not affect your primary task of the mailbox server of delivering the mails and doing whatever it needs to do with your mails.
All right. Now, I'm trying to remember if we really answered the question of the progression of building redundancy. Can you simply have two servers that run all of the services, or does it make more sense to separate the services into their own machines and then replicate them?
Right. And for that, the answer in the previous version was no. When you had a clustered mailbox server, you had to have the other roles on different hardware. Not anymore. In 2010, you can have a client access, a hub server, and a mailbox server role on the same server, and still establish a database availability group and create the database copies. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, it is beautiful. So, but then that backup machine is only running the mailbox service, effectively.
You mean in terms of roles?
Yeah.
You could have the roles on both servers.
Okay, so because in theory, if I'm really going to have reliability here, I want to have all of my services replicated.
Mm-hmm. And what also happens is the way the hub services handle the traffic, if you remember from 2007 days, is that when a mail comes in, the mail must go through the hub server. So if I deliver an email to a user who is also on the same database on the same mailbox server, the mail still goes through the hub server, right?
Okay.
And that's still true in 2010. So what's going to happen is if you are hosting a hub server on the same server as a mailbox server, the database and the transport resiliency that is provided by 2010 will be gone if you don't have another hub server.
Yeah,
so what you will need is you will need another hub server somewhere in the environment, whether it's co-hosted with your mailbox server on a different hardware or be it a role of its own. Because what happens now is if you co-host your roles, Exchange 2010 by default will try to look for another hub server and say, hey, do I have another hub server in my site that I can deliver the mail to, even if it's local, because that way the transport can keep a copy. If your server goes down, the mail is on another server as a copy. So when the database fails over, it can be redelivered and you don't lose the mail.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting reflex.
So you're saying that part of the logic of 2010 is that it goes out and it looks for availability of services so that it can make itself redundant. Is that what you're saying?
Right. And it does that at multiple layers. Your mailbox resiliency, you have the transport resiliency in form of shadow redundancy. So what it does is when it delivers the mail to the hub transport, it waits for the next hub. And once it receives the confirmation that I have delivered it to the next hub, then it deletes it from its resiliency, from its shadow resiliency cache.
That's very clever.
That is cool.
So, and to me, it also feels like then having two servers running all of the services with a DAG would provide us pretty good redundancy. Although, I mean, you're only one machine away from having no redundancy, but you're better off. Maybe my question really is that a normal thing to do, or do you normally see redundancy being six machines at a minimum?
Not necessarily. What we do recommend, so what 2010 enables you to do is have lower cost storage, right? Because of the serial writes, you could easily use a SATA drive and host your database on a SATA drive. What we also have talked about a lot is that you could now have a RAID-less storage. So you can just have a JBOD and host your databases on that. If you want to do that, then you would need more than two copies, because what happens is, like you said, you just have your one server over, right? If one fails, then you have just one more copy. So at that point, our support stance is that if you want to do a JBOD, if you want to do a RAID-less storage, make sure that you have three copies of the database. You have the three-server DAG.
Well, and this is new to me, because my experience with Exchange has always been that you use pretty redundant, reliable machines on this. RAID arrays, redundant power supplies, and so forth. You really don't want to lose an Exchange box, even though you still have redundancy in it as well. Now this is sounding more like a web farm, where cheap commodity hardware with multiple replicas, and we really don't care if we lose one.
Right. And that's because, again, go back to, you know, where we have come from the failover perspective, how quick it is and why. So it is quicker in terms of, taking over from the failed database, whether it's just the database level or the server level. And then your client doesn't see it because they are coming from the CAS. So that allows us to do that.
Right.
So we've addressed the redundancy component of high availability. What does Exchange 2010 have in it to aid us from the perspective of doing the bigger picture of high availability?
When you talk about disaster recovery.
Yeah, and you know, data centers go unavailable or you have a disaster, that type of thing. What?
Right. And so for that, you used to have the SCR in 2007, which I said earlier is gone as well with CCR. So the database availability group now spans across sites. So what you do is you have additional servers on the other side, whether it's a separate data center or separate data centers. You could have multiple ones.
Sure.
And then you could have different databases go to different places, you know, as your disaster recovery plan as a business allows you to do. So think of your DAG, and you have two sites, site A and site B. So you go from site A and site B. In site B, you implement a couple more DAG members, your mailbox servers, right? And then now you have a single DAG stretching across sites. Your database fails. You could have another server in the same site taking over. If the whole site fails, you could have all your databases activated on the servers on the site B.
Gotcha. You know, one more question, and this maybe isn't quite high availability, but I'm kind of curious, just based on having run into this a lot in the past, and if 2010 does anything for us to help make this easier. So you have a lot of mergers and acquisitions taking place in business these days where, you know, you have multiple companies that are running Exchange, or maybe a big company that's constantly acquiring other companies that are running Exchange, but they have to migrate all those users into the larger, say, the big acquiring company's Exchange environment. Is there anything in 2010 that simplifies that or makes that more robust or take less time or anything along those lines?
And you mean the process of acquisition, like bringing the users over from other farm, migrating them across the interorg? Is that what your question is?
That type of thing. That's sort of what I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah, because usually what you would be doing is you would have two separate forms, and depending on the acquisition, whether you have exchange on the other side or not, it could, you know, get complicated.
Right.
I'm not sure if 2010 makes it any better in that area.
Okay, I was just curious if there was anything, you know, that stood out.
Guys, we're getting close to the end of the show here. Bargav, any stories you might be able to tell us from your experience in the field of disaster recovery and exchange? I know there's probably not a lot of 2010 ones, but, you know, just any experience you could talk about?
Well, so the good thing is I did not have to be a part of a real disaster, which is always a good thing, which means I was either part of the environments that were healthy. And as a PFE, that's one thing, you know, that's part of our job. We have to make sure that we are healthy environment. But again, disaster is disaster. No matter how healthy your environment is, disaster can strike anywhere.
Sure.
Luckily, though, it didn't strike where we were. I was part of drills, disaster recovery drills, and that was very valuable, too, to look at your processes overall. Because when you think about disaster, it's not just technology, it's, you know, it's your business decisions making, logistics for your backups if you had to restore from backups, and the cohesion of other teams, because you are reliant on other teams and other teams are reliant on you. So a lot of disaster recovery actually is process more so than the technology itself.
Yeah.
And from this is not my direct experience, but one of the people I had talked to, what they had is they had a disaster, and the planning before the disaster was pretty good. They had the secondary data centers, they had everything in place, they had the processes documented. But where it can go wrong, this is a great example, is that the data center they were in where the disaster struck, it was just a one click. So what they had done is that you just do this one click and your disaster recovery scenario will progress and you will have your secondary data center operational, whatnot. The primary data center had a fire and the asbestos was in the air, so they just basically quarantined the building. You cannot go in the building. Well, guess what? Your recovery scenario is gone. You cannot push that button to initiate the recovery sequence.
Right.
So, like I said, you know, it takes a lot of planning. It's more of planning processes, thinking through the processes and obstacles, more so than technology. I mean, if you think about 2010, let's just say 2010, your primary data center failed. You have the servers on the other side. Great. What did you forget? You forgot your namespace planning. What if your namespace that users refer to was still pointing from the DNS to your primary data center that doesn't exist anymore?
Yeah.
Right, right.
You know, so it's more planning, a lot of planning than anything else.
And just contending with the fact that, you know, what if you can't get access to the building? What if there's a smoking hole in the ground where the building used to be?
Right.
Yeah, somebody blew up the button I have to push.
Yeah. I remember us working through a scenario like that and realizing, geez, our disaster recovery manual's only copy is in the building. We should keep a copy somewhere else.
We have a very good documentation, but it's not here.
Yeah, it's burnt up too.
Yep, and I just remember one thing about DAG that I would definitely like to mention for our listeners' benefit is that you have to keep one thing in mind when you talk about planning, is that your database availability groups are limited by one factor, and that's your maximum number of servers you can have in a group. Your DAG is limited to 15 servers.
50 or 15?
1-5.
So when you plan your DAG, whether in sight or with different sites, if it is stretched or not, make sure that you don't exceed that number.
Wow. And if you do exceed that number, what are you doing? That's a lot of servers.
Well, you're right. Well, and it's not always necessary that, you know, you don't have more users than the 15 servers can take. But at that point, what you want to do is you want to have a new DAG. You could have multiple DAGs, right?
Right.
So
okay.
Just establish a new DAG.
Okay, that makes sense.
Makes sense, yeah.
Well, guys, I think that's a show.
Thanks a lot. That's some really great information.
Thank you, guys. I really hope, you know, listeners are enjoying and benefiting from the information we share.
Bhargav, thanks so much for coming on the show.
All right. Thank you, guys.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.